You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Columbia Calling. I'm Emily Hart, and this week I'll be chatting to Nubia Rojas about journalism at war, how journalists fell victim to, but also took part in, Colombia's civil conflict. Nubia is a journalist and researcher who has worked on conflicts across the world, both as correspondent and as analyst, working for the United Nations, Doctors Without Borders, and Oxfam, as well as numerous Colombian outlets. Most recently, Nubia authored a chapter of the final report of Colombia's Truth Commission, a historic publication which was the outcome of an unprecedented investigation into the causes and consequences of Colombia's internal armed conflict. The final report was the result of nearly 4 years of work and tens of thousands of interviews. Today, we'll be chatting about Nubia's chapter, digging into the historical and present relationship between journalism and Colombia's political elites, paramilitary PR, rebel elites, corporate takeovers, and more. All that coming up, but first, your top news stories for this week. At least 10 armed groups in Colombia have agreed to participate in unilateral ceasefires in pursuit of peace negotiations, including FARC dissidents and the Clan del Golfo criminal group, the government has announced. Illegal armed groups in Colombia count around 6,000 militants in their combined ranks. A delegation from guerrilla group the National Liberation Army, known as the ELN, has travelled to Venezuela for a new phase in peace talks with the Colombian government. The talks will include representatives from Cuba, Norway, and Venezuela. The Colombian president announced last month that the government would suspend arrest warrants and extradition requests for members of the group in a bid to resume talks. The top commander of the ELN, Eliezer Erlinto Chamorro, alias Antonio Garcia, said this week that any process must seek profound change, seeking to make Colombian society more equitable with real and participative democracy and respect for human rights, rather than simply seeking political power for a few commanders. Controversy this week as Veronica Alcocer, Colombia's first lady, was appointed special mission ambassador to the United States, Japan, and the United Kingdom, making trips in the last month to attend events such as the funeral of Queen Elizabeth II. The role comes with substantial per diem expenses of 63 million pesos. Expenses for the furnishing of the presidential and vice presidential residences have also caused controversy this week. Contracts made public show expenditure on objects well over market prices, as well as luxury and imported furniture, appliances, and household items. This is especially problematic for the Pacto Histórico, who have made harsh criticisms of this sorts of spending by past governments. Land invasions continue and have raised the shadow of paramilitarism in rural Colombia. As cattle ranchers have started to discuss so-called solidarity reaction brigades to defend their land from invasions, some of which, according to leaked WhatsApp group chats, take the form of armed self-defense groups. In view of land invasions in several parts of the countries, these response groups were promoted by the president of Livestock Union, FEDEGAN, José Félix Laufaurie, to provide legal advice and react to the events. However, according to revealed WhatsApp messages, there are also intentions to respond with weapons in groups that are administered by FEDEGAN, a group who have historically been repeatedly accused of close links with paramilitaries during Colombia's civil conflict. Two criminal gangs, the Xotas and Espartanos, have sealed a local peace pact in the Pacific port town of Buenaventura. Their turf war and regular clashes have been responsible for an extreme wave of violence over the last 2 years, which has affected the life of the entire city. A pilot program that includes a ceasefire brokered by the Catholic Church began on Sunday with a football match. Colombia's central bank has raised interest rates from 9% to 10%. Inflation is now at over 10%, and risk rating agency Fitch has forecast that the country's economy will not grow more than 3% next year. In the days following the announcement, for the second time in history, the dollar rose to above 4,600 pesos, hitting a rate only 17 pesos below its record high, which it reached in mid-July of this year. Meanwhile, unemployment dropped to 10.6% in August, down from 11% in July, and having been at nearly 13% in August of last year. This is being taken as a sign of economic recovery from the pandemic. However, a gender gap persists. The unemployment rate for women is at 13.3% and for men at 8.7%. Colombian Senator Alirio Barrera arrived on Tuesday to Congress riding a horse after the president of the Senate declared the area pet-friendly. Barrera, a representative of right-wing opposition party Centro Democrático, entered Congress on horseback, claiming the horse was his pet. He claims it was an act to vindicate the importance of the countryside, of rural ways of life, and of the horse in rural economies and transport. Those were your top stories. More next week. So hello, Nubia, and welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Hello, Emily. Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's great to have you on. I've been, again, reading your amazing Truth Commission chapter, and I would love to just dive right in because there's an amazing introduction on the historical context of the report about journalism kind of throughout the 20th century. And it's an amazing lens on the 20th century in Colombia as well as in the war. So I'd love it if you could just give us a bit of a canter through, you know, the 20th century begins. Where is Colombian media? What's the situation?
I think it's very important to have in mind that the link between politics and journalism since the beginning has determined the way in which journalists have been working in Colombia. Since the beginning, that links between politics and journalists made that to be so close to the power made journalists think that they were also part of the power. And that's a very big problem because the main objective of journalism is not to be with the powerful people, with the power, but to be a counter power, actually. Trend to privilege the official source comes from the very, very beginning. That's not a shift, actually. The journalism has been so close to the power that they think that they are part of the power, but that they are serving the power too. And in a country where you have a very difficult conflict, a war, with so many casualties, with so many victims, with so many problems, with so many actors playing a role, to be so close to the power doesn't give the people the opportunity to really understand what's going on.
Right. That's something I found really, really interesting about the report is your relation of how the enormously dangerous situation forced media to rely on, for example, the military mm-hmm. to do their logistics, to give them information, to take them to parts of the country, and the ways that that affected neutrality.
Yes, but it's also the owners, the media owners, were also playing a very big role. And unfortunately, they are the very big... they are the absence in the discussion about what do we have to do to change the journalism in Colombia in order to make it more more useful to people in order to understand the conflict because all the people of course had their own. Ideas, political ideas, and they trace the way to the journalists. And yes, in the middle there is a lot of information what is missing, and many people who is not understanding, and many people who is only thinking what the media says or following the line from the media. So it's very, very complex. It's very difficult. That's why the document is very large. And in the middle of all that, the political polarization, it's very, very big. People is only in favor of one or other position, but they are missing the other part.
Right. So the first half of the 20th century feels very split along this liberal and conservative divide. Mm-hmm. So then what happens when those two groups join together after La Violencia from the Frente Nacional? How did the media change during the period of Pinilla, Frente Nacional, and also the rise of the FARC? How did the media deal with that?
I will say that they actually continue to see the polarized reality. In the Frente Nacional, for example, the liberals and conservatives, they were just changing their periods every 4 years. But I think that they were together in the idea that there was an enemy against the state. So I will say that journalists buy that idea about the enemy, and they started to replicate that idea from all that powerful politicians, no matter if they were conservatives or liberals. I think that that's the moment in which the concept of enemy against the state starts consolidating not only in the journalism but also in the political life and in the people, of course.
Right, because this is the 1960s, and as you write in the report, this is the time when the US policy, the, you know, what I think of as the red under the bed era of internal enemy, national security, anti-communism rhetoric. And that did, it seems, reach a lot of countries, and Colombia being one of them.
Yes, and if you maybe remember in the document, I address a very important issue aside the notion of the internal enemy, which is the idea of the national security. So everything you do in the name of the national security is okay, and it was not questioned because it was supposed to be in your best interest, in the public best interest, and that's what allowed all that political power to increase human rights violations, and the journalism was taking part by positioning themselves in with the power, aside the power, without questioning their practices. So that's a very important responsibility to have in mind. Let's say that at the beginning, before the Frente Nacional, they were taking a part of the power because they were the journalism worked in big media by the very big families, the political families, and after the Frente Nacional, they continue to be with that political power, but also legitimating that discourse.
Right, and there were cross-media accords to cover violence in certain ways, or even not to cover the rise of the FARC, or there's a particularly interesting period during the rise of the paramilitaries, mm-hmm. in which the media take a very specific stance on those groups.
Yes. Yes, I think that's a very, that it's a very big responsibility. And I will say it's important not to talk about the whole media or the whole journalists. That's not fair, I think, because many journalists lost their lives actually for defending the truth and opposing that very bad practices. But some journalists, some media, in some places, defending some kind of power for their own interests, participating, and they have a very big responsibility in the increasing of the conflict. Not the same responsibility, of course, that the armed groups, but of course they have a very big responsibility.
It's such an interesting side effect, I think, of journalism having been in many countries, my own included, a very middle class activity, often being, you know, as I'm sure you can hear from my voice, also being, you know, of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
If there are elites protecting their own interests, often journalists become complicit in that because the interests of the elite are their own interests.
Yes.
And throughout the 20th century, we've had editors of major newspapers in Colombia being literal blood relations of the president, right? Or presidents who were journalists.
And that, yes, and that's a very calculated practice, I think, because if you have the political power and at the same time you are the owner of the big newspapers, of course you have the best way to broadcast your ideas and to make the people know what you need them to think or to know, you know? It's a very calculated effect. And then,
right,
when the big economic groups are the new owners of that's not the same, but it has the same consequence. They need people to buy, but not only to buy products, but to buy their links with the power. So it's a sort of many powers working together to get some results, to make the people know what they need them to know. It's very calculated, I think.
Right. And I think not something, and I think this is important to point out, that is at all specific to Colombia. This is absolutely a global phenomenon. I mean, in the country that I am from, our prime minister, mm-hmm. former prime minister, thankfully now, although how you feel about Liz Truss is a whole different thing. He was a columnist on the Times. His sister has been a journalist for a number of years, writes about him a lot, is now host of her own show on one of those dogshit right-wing radio shows. And his sister was, for a very long time, and may still be, the tennis doubles partner of the editor of the Times. You know, we are not talking about this as a Colombian phenomenon. I want to say it's a global one from other research I've done, but certainly in my country. And then in a conflict situation, that's obviously a completely aggravated set of effects, right?
Yeah, that was what I was about to say. It's different. Of course, it's important. Of course, it's not desirable. But in a country with a very big conflict and with a polarized society and with very, very big differences between poor people and rich people, that's even more important. It has bigger consequences because there is a manipulation, a bigger manipulation. If you don't have people very well educated, if the access to education or to job positions or to the richness is not equal for everyone, of course you are taking profits from the poor people, and you need them to defend your war. If you see who are the soldiers, most of them are poor people, poor boys, and who are the owners of the big media, who are positioning their discourses, the rich people. So you can see that the inequality it's evident also in that sort of things. So it's very complex. It's not that easy to say that only they only have economical interests, because of course behind that economic interest they have political interests.
Right, and the phenomenon which you write about in the chapter, which I think is a really interesting moment for media, is Revista Alternativa, mm-hmm. Which is a kind of moment of rebellion against this nationalist internal enemy discourse. And it was Gabriel García Márquez who was involved in it, which I think not many people know, actually, or not enough people know, that he was quite a serious journalist as well as being a great novelist. But it also had quite a lot of the media's elite involved in it, though it was an anti-establishment magazine. And how long did they last? It didn't seem like it was, you know, as much as it was a hopeful project, it wasn't an enormously successful one in that difficult climate.
It was not very... I have something to say about Gabo. That actually, García Márquez was first a journalist than a writer, actually.
Exactly, yeah.
That's something that not so many people know about him. And Alternativa is a very, very special experience in the Colombian journalists. But the paradoxical thing is that in a way, Alternativa was also a part of the elite, a rebel elite, because if you remember, one of the members of the board in Alternativa, the director actually was Enrique Santos Calderón, which is a member of the Santos family, brother of Juan Manuel Santos, our...
Total insider.
Yes, but he's a rebel, I mean, and a very good journalist. And they were very, very courage people, because they... And Antonio Caballero, too. Antonio Caballero, García Márquez, and many journalists in Alternativa, they were themselves a part of important families, intellectual families, but a sort of rebel family, the rebel members of that families. And they tried to make something different, which has which was very, very successful, but not for a long time, because that ideas about the internal enemy and the extreme right ideas and the to be so close to the United States was so well built that it was very, very difficult to fight against us. And that journalists were also prosecuted. They were victims of listenings and many hostility against them. But that was very important. But they were not perfect, we have to say. They were not perfect. They Santos, for example, recognized, and Enrique Santos recognized that they were not always so... they were not listening always the other side. That they were also trying to impose their own ideas. So that's interesting.
Yeah, there's a great anthology of Alternativa coverage, which I really recommend to anyone listening, because it's a really interesting insight into what this magazine was doing. And I kind of love the idea of a rebel elite and all of the tensions that embodies. But at the same time, in many ways, they were the only people for whom that would have been safe. you know, the elite are sometimes in a situation that dangerous, the people who can rebel without serious threat to their lives. I mean, nobody was going to bump off. Well, there were two bomb attempts against mm-hmm. their home yes. shortly before they had to close down. But I think another thing that's interesting about this report is how it highlights, you know, one journalist is not all journalists. Some people were in such different situations of security
yes.
to others. And journalists throughout this conflict in, let's say, Bogota, who came under attack, had a very different experience to local journalists who did.
Yes. And of course, for that local journalists, it's very difficult to make the job that they do because they don't belong to any elite, even local elites, for example, because the local elites, maybe they are the owners of the local media, but they have another interest. They are not necessarily covering conflict or covering peace issues. They are making something right. different.
So I think an interesting period to look at as a kind of acute representation of the internal enemy and actually a kind of belated grabbing onto the national security narrative is the Uribe period.
Uh-huh.
And his government produced a manual. Your yes. chapter for the Truth Commission talks about a manual that they more or less imposed on journalists in terms of covering the war.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Because the extreme power always tries to have power over the journalism, of course. And if you are not the owner of the media, but you are the president, of course you need to improve the way in which you have your influence, especially if you are being questioned, which happened with Uribe.
Right. And I think there's something interesting in the different ways that the mainstream media in Colombia covered the guerrilla versus the paramilitaries.
Mm-hmm.
Because you write that in some ways the coverage of the paramilitaries in Colombia was one of the great failures of the media,
mm-hmm.
That responsibilities were not met. What did you mean by that?
I think that in part, the paramilitary violence was not very well covered because some media, some owners and some journalists had sympathy. And of course, if you are sympathetic with them, you are not going to question them, of course. But in the other hand, for many years, for many decades, the very big internal enemy was the guerrilla. So the journalism was more ready to criticize the guerrilla actions instead of the paramilitary actions because there was a surrounding idea that they were the bad boys and the paramilitaries, they were the good boys, you know, because they are helping the army to fight against guerrillas, and they are trying to keep that the status quo. And no, of course I am simplifying yeah. very much, but that's the reason, I think. But I have to say that there were also journalists trying to reveal the human rights violations from the paramilitaries, of course.
Right. And then in terms of the kind of personalization of the paramilitary leaders, one of my favorite passages in your chapter is the relation of these one-on-one, cara-a-cara mm-hmm. interviews with Carlos Castaño, who, you know, to my mind is one of the great bad guys
mm-hmm.
Of the Colombian conflict. You know, having been an associate of Pablo Escobar, he was then the leader of the Autodefensas Unidas de Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asked about his childhood on national television and allowed to sort of be a human being in civil clothing.
Yes, and Castaño had a very good he was very, he had the ability to connect the big issues in Colombia with his own discourse. I mean, people in Colombia is very like very much the discourse about God, the family, the sons, discourse about the family and God. And Castaño had the very good idea. He was very clever to connect his discourse with that kind of issues. And that interview, interviews with Carlos Castaño, because there were two, with two different journalists, were in a moment in which the people was tired and angry because the peace process with the FARC was not going anywhere. So everything was made to help people, to help Castaño to get the sympathy from the people. It was very calculated in a part, but also because the guerrilla was not in that moment, the guerrilla was not a source for the journalists. So there was a very, very big difference between the visibility of Castaño and the autodefensas and the visibility of the FARC.
That's so interesting. I mean, the importance of PR and marketing effectively, mm-hmm. even in war, is so highlighted in this particular context. So why, you know, to put it simply, why did the paramilitaries do so much better at public relations than the FARC? Were they just better at it, or did they have better access? Or
because they are closer to the power than guerrillas.
Mm.
And because they have the, in their discourse, they have many, many similarities with the power, the political power discourse in Colombia. So, of course, they had a very good opportunity. They had the links with the politicians in the local, regional, and national spheres. And their actions were legitimized by the media, which were also closed to that power. So everything was made.
Right. And this is during a period where Uribe is exercising quite effective media control, in the sense of military wins are on the front pages.
Yes.
And massacres are somewhere hidden in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And a really interesting detail you noted was about photos of tragedies being put in black and white rather than colour.
Yes.
So that they would draw the eye of the reader less.
And if you remember, in the 60s, some initiatives to make journalism softer, speaking about the conflict, and for example, not mentioning the big names from the bandoleros leaders, or not talking very too much about the violence in some areas. That has been very interesting to research and to understand, because it has been an alliance between the journalism and the political power to undercover the conflict. It's very, I don't know if there are many, many, many places in the world in which that kind of alliances take place, but it's very interesting.
It's fascinating. And I think one of the great moments of transformation that your report captures really brilliantly is the move into conglomerates.
Mm-hmm.
From big families, liberal, conservative, pro-state, anti-state, we move into RCN, Caracol, and the kind of entertainment as news phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Where journalists on these channels suddenly have to look a certain way. and they become very commercialized. So what were the effects of that on war reporting?
In Colombia, the economical and the political power are very closed. In some cases, they are the same. So that change between the ownership, the media ownership from the big political families and the big economic groups, it's important, but ideologically speaking, has no many difference. The thing is that in a very long conflict, such as the Colombian, with so many actors, of course there is many people with many different interests, also economic interests. It's not only a political conflict. The Colombian conflict is not only a political conflict; it's also an economic conflict, and that's why, for example, we have the third. I don't know how to explain this in English, but which is say the terceros responsables, people who is not fighting, people who is not going to the war, but who is financing the war, you know?
I mean, the direct translation is third parties.
Yes, third party.
But it's not quite right. I'm not sure there is a perfect translation. But the people who are sort of the economic motor and the economic winners of the war.
Yes, but also we have to say that not every not every enterprise or not every economic group in Colombia has been participating or responsible. Right. That's I emphasize very much in that kind of things, to not to speak about the journalism or the journalists or the politicians or the economical power in general, because that's not fair.
Massively. So the quality of news, or the presentation of news, slightly changes form during this explosion of television news.
Yes, that's what I called the vedette journalist. In that moment, began the trend to make the journalists the journalists became the figures, the stars, not the news. And that's a consequence of the economical power, because in the media. Before, you had very big names in journalism, journalists who were very well, which have very good reputation because they were very good researchers or very good journalists, without considering if they were beauty or no. But suddenly, the journalists, especially the women journalists, became the stars, no, and like models or the anchors, and it's very, and that superficiality in the news, decreasing the quality, decreasing the importance of some issues, including the conflict, also because they had the idea, or they have some of them they are still having the idea that the conflict is very hard and people need to speak about another different things, and let's talk about the legs from blah blah blah, or the beautiful face from blah blah blah. The quality has been decreasing very much.
Right, the focus on entertaining people or pacifying them. You know, in England we have a real penchant for animal stories. The news will have like the horrors of the world, and then 10 minutes on a squirrel that has learned to water ski. And that's a kind of equivalent. That we also have this problem of the aestheticization of female journalists.
Yes.
And the need for the person telling you about a massacre in Santander for some reason needing to have cleavage and a full face of makeup. Which is a really extraordinary culture shift I think, that comes with television.
Yes, and it's also another kind of power. If you think about it, it's another kind of power. Who has more power in the media? Who has the most beautiful anchor or the most beautiful model telling the news? It's very, yeah, and also the quality of the news has decreased or faces many, many problems because of the low quality of the education in the journalists. In part because many students in the journalism colleges are aspiring to be models or to be anchors with the long legs and beautiful faces instead of people more conscious about where do they live and where are they working and what kind of journalism are they doing.
Right, and of course the overwhelmingly white aesthetic. I think there's an important ethnic element here as well, is that this elite of beauty in television is also white women.
Yes.
There's a real failure of representation that goes on both regionally and ethnically in that television revolution, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And still.
Yes, and closing the way, the opportunity to new ways to make journalism. I think that Colombia has very big and professional journalists, many people who is doing a very good work and very professionally and very worried about the reality, very qualified. But it's a pity that they don't have more space to express themselves and to give very good and bigger analysis about the reality, and that's especially critical in a country with a conflict, because many important right. voices are not speaking loud, and we need them.
Yeah, I think another key moment that's outside of the scope of maybe the time frame of the report, but I'm sure that you have thoughts on, is Semana being sucked into this vortex
yes.
of conglomerate purchasing and the loss of platform that a lot of, you know, Colombia is full of amazing journalists, and so many of them lost a massive platform in that moment.
Yes, that's right. And for example, that example that you say about Semana was the most important magazine in Colombia, talking about political issues. They had a very many relevant journalists in Colombia started their careers in Semana or come from Semana, and now you read Semana and you say, okay, that it's very difficult to think that was the most important magazine in Colombia, political magazine in Colombia.
It's extraordinary. I mean, the headlines have become clickbait.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, here's something we saw on Instagram about a reggaetonero,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, they would never have dreamt of publishing before. But I suppose that is a kind of part of this new corporate culture where your outlet is just another business and it has to make money. And the bottom line is it, you know, it comes alongside a soft drink company and a football team, for example, in the case mm-hmm. of RCN.
Yes, because you only need people to do clickbait, and you are getting money from that. And you only need the people to see the announcements, the publicity, you are only thinking about money. You are not caring right. about information, and that's some of the very bad consequences of converting media in economic conglomerates.
This report is very even keeled. It it asks that journalists take responsibility for their mistakes and that the media industry really looks at how it functioned to propagate government narratives and perpetrate the conflict, as well as being victims of those conflict actors.
Yes, these are two phases of the same coin, and your responsibility mm-hmm. and how your own work makes you an objective for the armed groups. Usually, journalists have been perceived as victims, not as responsibles, and that's why I wanted to talk about the responsibility too. First of all, every single armed group, every single responsible in the conflict has been a perpetrator for journalists. Everyone. The army, I mean the state, the paramilitaries and the guerrillas, and the narcotraffic, of course. But the report does not emphasize in the narcotraffic because we prior the armed conflict. I mean the guerrilla, paramilitaries and army. The perpetrators, of course, have the common intention to undercover the truth and to hide their own interests, of course. And in the middle of that war, the journalists became victims because they were trying to show the people what was happening and what were the intentions, the objectives from that armed groups. The state has been especially responsible, and I emphasize in especially responsible because the state is supposed to guarantee the human rights and the press freedom and the freedom of expression. So the state has a bigger responsibility, if you want, to see that responsibility in that way. The paramilitaries also tried to, and they killed many, many journalists. The narcotraffic in the 90s, many casualties, many different ways to warn journalists about what to say, what not to say, even the sources. Some journalists became targets because, for example, they were speaking with guerrillas or the paramilitaries, and a journalist has to speak with everyone, no matter who. So it's very for armed groups. That has been very difficult to understand.
So, you know, I don't want to talk about post-conflict era because obviously so much of Colombia still lives under armed group occupation. But the post-peace accords era in which, you know, journalism could be facing a new stage. Did journalism in Colombia change after the accords were signed? Has there been a kind of shift away from this us and them, enemy and ally narrative?
In part, yes. In part, yes, because the peace and conflict, of course, are related, but covering peace and covering conflict is different. Violence is very visible. When you are covering a conflict, you have the victims and the facts before your eyes. They are very evident to you. And that's why it's too easy to talk about how many people is dead, how many people... I mean, not easy, not literally easy, but the violence is very eloquent. It's very visible.
Right.
But when you're covering peace issues, you have to find the stories. You have to go to people, to find what's different, what has been changing, what are the new dynamics, which are the new actors. After the peace process, the Colombian journalists experienced a very amazing period, I would say. But it's a pity that that trend doesn't continue because during the Duque government, the peace issues were relegated to a second place, to the third and fourth and the last place possible. So
right.
We were talking before about the links between the journalism and the power, and in that period, the only media who kept on covering peace issues were the media which were independent enough to have their own agenda and to keep on talking about peace, no matter if Duque was interested or not. That's very interesting.
And do those outlets, the independent ones, do they have the same level of resource and access as the outlets that are close?
For example, it's interesting the case of El Espectador, which started being a very, I would not say officialist, because El Espectador has always had a trend to be independent, even being liberal from the beginning. But for example, El Espectador has made a very important work covering the peace issues and covering the conflict, and they have a very big visibility. But something interesting is that in recent years we have seen some new independent, very very independent, also in economically speaking, independent media talking about conflict and peace issues. For example, I think I mentioned someone in some of them in the report, Bora Jiné, Liga Contra el Silencio, and many of them.
And of course, Cambio, which is the newest.
Cambio and many interesting experiences of independent journalists. So in one hand, we have a very big economic conglomerates taking more privileging the power. And then the other hand, we have some interesting independent media trying to privilege the interest of the public.
I want to wrap up by talking about a final actor. And I've never seen anyone write this clearly about this really key actor in this whole question. Which is us, which is the reader. Because while the state has a responsibility to implement security and also human rights, and journalists have a responsibility to report independently, you write that the audience and the reader, and I'm going to translate this probably horribly because I'm looking at the Spanish here, but the right to be well-informed implies a duty to demand quality information, not that which is morbid. You have to assume an active role, deliberate, and not of a simple passive consumer. And I think that's genius, because I think that is our duty. And it's all very well to say, oh, the media, isn't it terrible?
Yes.
But we have to be active, conscious consumers of that media.
Colombia is a democracy with many, many problems, but it is a democracy. And in a democracy and in a capitalist country like Colombia, the audience and the public and the people have the right and the possibility to choose. And in the same way that you have the possibility to choose what you buy in the supermarket, you have the same possibility to choose what are you consuming in news. What kind of news are you consuming? If you are a passive audience, if you are not critical about what are you looking at the news in the television? What are you listening in the radio? Or what are you reading in the newspaper? They are not forcing you to read them or to listening to or to watch. They are not forcing you. It's your decision. And you also have the right to say, I will no longer consume that shit. I will no longer read that newspaper. And maybe that's the way in which the newspaper and the radio and the television has to change or to qualify their content, because people is not consuming it.
I think that's a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much, Nubia, for joining us.
Thank you, Emily. Sorry,
your amazing work.
Oh, sorry again.
I realized I said dog shit earlier as well without even thinking about it. So thanks, guys. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for putting up with our shit. And see you next week. Thanks so much, Nubia.
Thank you, Emily. Thank you. Bye.
Ciao.
This episode was brought to you by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean. Since 1967, their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. And also, our other sponsor is BNB Colombia Tours, experts in custom-made travel throughout Colombia. The team at BNB Colombia Tours can provide you with fantastic private experiences, creating wonderful memories of Colombia for a lifetime. Check out the website at bnbcolombia.com, complete the free itinerary form, and tell them that Colombia Calling sent you to receive a further 5% off their already great prices. So that's bnbcolombia.com and, of course, latinnews.com. Thank you for everyone for listening. That's us. Farewell. And, of course, check back next week. Bye-bye.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.